Blog Talk Radio.
January 30th, 2012. I'm your host, Comrade L, and somewhere in the background there is Robin Eduardo. She had some technical difficulties, and I believe she's on the air now. Are you there, Robin?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I can hear you. How perfect is that? Okay. Brief intro to the show's today. Today's show, we are going to have on two authors, father and son team by the name of Brian and Jonathan Anderson. And Robin, they're from the from your neck of the woods there in New York or New Jersey, close by. And they will be talking about their book, The Godling Chronicles. It's a fantastical read, and I'm sure you're going to want to run out and get a copy of that, either hardcover or electronic copy, right after the show. The Writer's Lounge blog is located over at tomrydell.com/blog. And once you get in there and you see the reviews of the authors, you can go there and read your review and also listen to the show on Blog Talk Radio Player in the upper right-hand corner of each review page. Also, on the Blog Talk Radio link page, you will find the Facebook link for the Writer's Lounge, which is developing a lot of likes lately, and I think we're up to 816 the last time I looked, and so we're shooting for that magic number of 1,000. So if you're out there and you're a liker of our show, please promote it to your friends and family, and we'd much appreciate that. Also, of course, we have an email, and it's tw11@yahoo.com. Send us your comments, your questions, your concerns, and your, well, you know, if you got any disagreements with what we're talking about. But I'm sure you won't, because we both do a good job here. So go ahead and send us your email, and be aware that we will be opening up show dates here, Robin, probably within the next 3 to 4 weeks. And those show dates will open up from April through, I believe we're going to go 4 months, so April, May, June, and July. So get ready for that and keep listening to the show. And caller instructions for today's show with Brian and Jonathan Anderson. If you'd like to give us a call, you can do that at 626-213-5613 or toll-free at 877-878-1436, and we'll be waiting for your calls. Once they get on the air, you can call in and we'll get your question or comment right to Brian and Jonathan. So as we normally do during this segment, we go into segment number one, which is Writer's Topics, and this is where I introduce my wonderful co-host, Robin Eduardo. You can talk now, Robin.
Well, I've got a bit of some news, but I'm not 100% sure if I'm participating yet, but I'm considering it. I was invited, of course, it has nothing to do with writing, but you know that I'm going to try to insert some type of a promo opportunity into it, but at Roxy and Duke's Roadhouse in Dun Ellen, New Jersey. I believe it's Saturday, February 18th. They're going to have a zombie beauty pageant.
Whoa.
Yeah, so I was invited to participate.
Are you going to be the queen? Are you going to be the queen of the ball?
Listen, this is the way I'm looking at it, because I've been to this restaurant a couple of times, and it's really eclectic, rockabilly. They have a stage set up. Like, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, kind of like a biker bar.
Well, it's called a roadhouse. So in a way, yes, I guess there's a little bit of a biker element, but I'll tell you what, it's more like a skater element, a tattoo element. There's, they have ska bands, reggae bands, unusual, well, you know, just anything that's out there, wild and crazy. They also have vaudevillian style acts, belly dancers, striptease artists. I mean, it's just all over the place. And the stage is set up just like the old style stages with the clamshell stage lighting, you know, along the edge of the stage, and the big red velvet curtains, and it's very eclectic. They have a they serve food, but it's neat because it's like all the tables and chairs are mismatched, and basically the owner, he's an artist, so he scoured all types of flea markets and antique places and just gathered up all this random but interestingly carved chairs and then repainted them, and then he would take old rock concert t-shirts and use them to to recover the seating, you know, the mat, whatever the seating cover.
Yeah.
So it's just red, black, and purple. That's all I can tell you. It's really crazy in there. It's a lot of fun. It's random. I really think I'd like to participate, although it's kind of short notice. February 18th is really, really close. And to get back to your question, am I going to be the zombie queen or the beauty queen? You know, I'm going to be 52 years old in May. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of 20.
Come on, Robin.
No, but listen, there's going to be a lot of 20-something-year-old girls, and there is a bathing suit contest.
Well, Robin, you have got the stilettos, and you've got the purse now, and you can rock your way right in there and show yourself off. Come on, 52.
Listen, this is my plan. I'm not going to go for sexy. It says it's a zombie beauty pageant.
Exactly.
But doesn't necessarily mean that you have to show skin. So I'm thinking if I do it, I'm going to scour the old vintage or like secondhand clothing stores for like the wackiest looking 50s or 60s style poofed out prom dress. And that's going to be my evening wear. And I'm just going to shred it up, bloody it up.
There you go.
And, you know,
kind of like Carrie in the movie Carrie in Stephen King's novel there.
Exactly. I'm going to go for shock value. And I, again, like I said, it's not written in stone that I'm going to participate. I'm still considering it. I want to try to get together a posse because I'll definitely need a cheering, you know, a cotillion of fans in the audience to cheer me on. But the talent portion, because I really don't have a talent, except just being silly. But what I figured what I would do is read a really intense excerpt from my upcoming novel.
Cool.
So, yeah, there'll be like a double whammy because I'll be able to promote the novel and do it in a way that, you know, it fits with the theme. And you know, we'll see what happens. You know, we'll see what happens.
Then what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to read it on the Writer's Lounge, too, so we can all hear what you're going to read there.
Well, I'm assuming there's either going to be videotape or pictures taken if I do it.
Okay.
So right now it's just in the planning stages, but I'm giving everybody a heads up because it sounds like it's a very high likelihood that this is going to go down. I was just notified this morning about it, so... But I just thought that was a bit of really cool news that I wanted to share with everybody.
It would pass along. I believe next week we have another show to do, and we can kind of let everybody know about that little get-together that you're going to have in your neck of the woods. And before I get into my subject, which I'm going to talk about today,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask you, if zombies eat fish? And I'm not talking about the cooked variety. I'm talking about right out of the lake.
Wait, why?
Do zombies eat dead fish? Well, I'm sorry.
Would a zombie eat a dead fish?
No, a live fish.
A live fish. Okay, I think that, because we do have these discussions, believe it or not, on these crazy forums that I belong
yeah.
to. Because everybody thinks, well, not everybody, but, I mean, people are aware that, you know, some films portray zombies as they want brains. Now, it makes no sense why they would want brains only when there's warm flesh. So my theory, it would be pretty much any warm-blooded animal.
Okay. So
but
that would be
I don't know.
Out.
Are fish warm-blooded?
I don't know. I have
or
to check.
They,
in fact, I'm going to be checking tomorrow because we're heading with a friend up into northern Minnesota to one of those vast lakes up there, and we're going to be doing some ice fishing from a very nice,
so cool.
very nice ice house. It's got
TV
in there.
Oh, I love ice fishing.
It's got microwave. It's got flat screen TV. So we're really looking forward to that.
Luxurious.
But, exactly, and I can't wait. I haven't done that since 1978, so that's going to be a big thing for me. Anyway, what I'd like to talk about today is something that we'd like to promote in an upcoming show or shows. We can make this a mm-hmm. weekly thing or a biweekly thing as we do our shows, or we can do it once a month. I'm not sure yet. But Brian uh-huh. Anderson, who will be on here shortly with his son, suggested mm-hmm. to me that we might start some sort of a what I'm going to call Kids Corner, and that would be addressed to all parents. And I don't even know if they even have PTAs now, or schools who would like to promote reading and especially writing to their children and students. And the way it would work would be we here at the Writer's Lounge in a future show, as I said, and on our Facebook page, we will offer a writing topic for kids to write about. Could be write about a ghost story, write about your favorite vacation, or why mm-hmm. is your mom or dad special to you, something like that. Well, we'll go with, say, three age groups, 7 to 9, 10 to 12, and 13 to 15, and I would say send them into TWL, send your stories into TWL, and we'll pick the winners to be read by the authors on air. Or if you were like me at that age and you were shy, we could read them for you. So what do you think about that, Robin?
I think that's a great idea.
I think
that's a great idea. Yeah, and the thing is there's such an influx right now hitting big in the young adult genre that's something that I think that we should tap into and try to encourage more children to read, because I mean, as a parent, to a limit, I mean, I really don't care what my kids are reading as long as they're reading.
Exactly.
not something wild and crazy and out there, but I mean, it even if it's comic books, if it encourages a love of reading, generally kids who can read well do better in school. So I think that would be a great idea to promote something like that.
What we'll do is we'll suggest it to Brian and our ideas to him, and we can talk it over at some point off the air and get his feedback on there. But I'd like to get into our main attraction today, which is Brian and Jonathan Anderson. The book, The Godling Chronicles, Book 1, The Sword of Truth, was written by Brian D. Anderson and published by Inkwater Press in 2011. You may purchase it at Amazon.com/Kindle, and you can visit the author on Facebook. The Amazon description goes like this. It has been 500 years since the great war between elf and human ripped the world apart, and the dark knight of Angrail has stolen the sword of truth. With it, he has trapped the gods in heaven. If left unchallenged, he will kill the gods and reshape the world into an unimaginable hell. The only hope for all of creation is a boy named Gui Steding, the only being born from the union of two gods. Aided by Lee Starfinder, the son of Seraph, god of the sea and mortal woman, he must discover the true nature of his power. However, this will not be easy. He is bound to earth, a mortal man, and in many ways is very human. When Kalia, a young elf woman, joins their party, Gui discovers that perils of the heart can be as treacherous as any sword. Gui, Lee, Kalia, and other friends they meet on their journey must battle the Dark Knight, find a way to heal the hatred between elf and man, and restore heaven itself. And that was Amazon's description of that novel. This debut novel by Brian D. Anderson, which was inspired and conceived by his 8-year-old son, Jonathan, grabbed me from the beginning and pulled me into a fantastical world populated by elves, humans, and gods. I traveled with the main characters, Gui, Lee, and the adorably mysterious elf, Kalia, who I'm madly in love with, on a traveling quest to learn more about the world around them and to develop Gui's powers, which will be needed to defeat the Dark Knight. The author's skills of character development, descriptions of place and action scenes, parallels, and stands up and shines with other stories in this genre. I was most intrigued and very interested in Kalia's story and the culture of the elves and how for 500 years humans and elves made a decision not to coexist. In this story, the barriers between the humans and elves begins to crumble as they learn more and more about each other, and love even begins to blossom between them. Without giving away too much of the story, when a declaration is made by an elfin woman, she becomes devoted and spiritually bonded to the one making the declaration. It is more than a conscious decision. It is embedded into who and what they are as elves, but also doesn't come without peril. The story is filled with adventure, mystery, and love, and I highly recommend this book and the ones that will follow book one. Brian D. Anderson was born in 1971 and grew up in the small town of Spanish Fort, Alabama, and he attended Fairhope High, then later Spring Hill College, where his love for fantasy grew into a lifelong obsession. His hobbies include chess, history, and spending time with his son. And now Robin and I are very excited to introduce and welcome both Brian and his son Jonathan to the Writer's Lounge. And let me just fire up the phone here and get them on the air, and let's see if they're there. Brian and Jonathan, are you there?
We're here, Tom. How you doing?
Well, my friend, it's nice to hear your voice after chatting to you forever on Facebook.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're thrilled to be here.
Yeah, that's great. And I guess Robin and you have something in common. You're practically neighbors.
Yeah, I'm over here in Staten Island. You're over in New Jersey, I take it, Robin.
How close are you to Tottenville?
How close am I to Tottenville? Not too far. I mean, you know, Staten Island's not too close. I'm about dead center of the island, right off the expressway.
Because I'm right across the water.
In about 10 minutes.
Like,
but
I could see the beach from my side. I could see the beach in Tottenville.
Oh, nice.
Like, I could swim across if I wanted to.
Very good. Watch out, Brian.
I'm of the opinion that if there is snow that lands there, it should not be really called a beach.
Yeah, I know.
It has been a shoreline.
It's kind of like, you know, they dump some sand and spread it around and said, okay, this is a beach.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'll tell you. I've heard it's gotten better, but the first time I went, I was, you know, I'm from, like, the white sand beaches of the Gulf Coast. I was like, oh, my God, what is
this?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, you sit there and you get some sunshine, but you really don't want to go swimming in the water because you might come back out glowing in the dark.
with gills.
Yeah.
Gills, third eye.
That's what I'll be seeing up at the lake, hopefully, here this weekend.
What, three-eyed fish?
I hope so.
That would be cool.
It'll be something to write about, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I think you might owe the Simpsons copyright if you did that.
Yeah.
So, Brian, where's Jonathan? Is he there?
He's right here beside me. I
Hello,
was
Jonathan.
On the speaker, but I wasn't. Say hi.
Hi.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hey.
Okay,
yeah, I didn't
Brian,
want to put it on speakerphone because you know I wasn't sure how the voice would come in. So.
Very good.
Yeah.
Brian, get on with the questions.
When the time comes.
Getting on with the questions here. Can you read an excerpt from the Godling Chronicles for us?
Absolutely. I'll read an excerpt from chapter 5. I chose this for several reasons. All right, here we go. See if I can get through this without fumbling it. They barely slept the next day and spoke hardly a word to each other. Lee waited until it was fully dark before they continued. They zigzagged through the forest for hours, stopping from time to time to listen for signs of pursuit. But much to Gooey's relief, there were none. After a time, the flat ground transitioned into steep wooded hillsides that made changing direction increasingly difficult. You do know where we are, don't you? Gooey asked, breaking the silence. Lee scowled. Would you rather guide us? He replied irritably. Gooey shook his head and kept quiet. It was about 2 hours before sunrise when Lee brought them to a sudden halt and leapt from the saddle, drawing his sword. He motioned for Gooey to stay still and disappeared into the night. Gooey's heart was pounding, and he drew his own sword, peering into the darkness. 10 minutes later, Lee reappeared. What's going on? Asked Gooey. There's an encampment just ahead, Lee whispered. Looks like bandits. Bandits, said Gooey. What are they doing? Lee mounted his horse and urged him forward, not noticing us, apparently. Looks as if they found some sport. So I doubt they'll see us pass. What kind of sport? Gooey inquired. They captured an elf, Lee responded. How that band of morons managed it, I don't know, but I imagine they'll be busy with her for a while. Gooey halted. It's a woman? What will they do with her? Lee turned. It's not a woman. It's an elf. And you don't want to know what they're going to do. You don't mean to let them kill her, do you? Gooey asked, appalled. Lee reined in his horse. That's exactly what I mean to do, boy. We don't have time for heroics, and even if we did, she's a bloody elf. Gooey got down from his horse. I don't care what she is, he said determinedly. I'm going to save her. You can help me? Or you can sit here and do nothing. I don't care either way. Gooey began to creep off into the darkness to look for the bandit's cow. Fool, Lee grumbled. He dismounted and caught up with Gooey. You're not ready for this, boy. Lee grabbed his shoulder and pulled Gooey behind him. Just stay in the brush and let me take care of it. Gooey followed behind Lee as quietly as he could. They had only walked a few yards when they heard the yells and curses of the bandit camp. The glow of the bandit's fire became brighter as they approached, and Lee could smell the stench of unwashed bodies mingling with scorched, burnt meat. When they got close enough, Gooey could make out 6 bandits, each with a long knife at their side. A few bedrolls were cast carelessly about, and a single bandit guarded 6 horses tied off several yards from the fire. The rest were gathered around what appeared to be a young woman. She was on her knees, gagged and bound, with her wrists tied behind her back. A man that seemed to be their leader was squatting in front of her, while the rest passed a large jug of wine around, laughing hideously. Well, 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 me lovely, the bandit leader chuckled. Look at what we have here, lads. Thought you could sneak up on old Durst, did you? The elf glared defiantly at the bandit leader. Boy, ain't she a tough one, a heavy-set bandit joked. I think she's sweet on you, Captain. Well, lads, said the leader, flashing an evil grin. I'm quite the ladies' man, after all. This brought gales of harsh laughter from the rest of the band. The leader stood up and grabbed the jug, draining it dry. Stay here, whispered Lee, and silently moved around the camp to where the horses were being kept. With the lone guard's attention focused on the elf, he neither noticed Lee's approach nor noticed Lee's knife until it plunged into the back of his neck. Before the first guard hit the ground, Lee had already drawn his sword and was rushing in on the rest of the group. Gu had never seen someone move so fast. He killed two more bandits before the others noticed he was there. The leader managed to unsheathe his long knife and lunged clumsily at Lee. But Lee easily dodged the blow, sending the man tumbling to the ground. The two remaining bandits tried to flee, but Lee quickly caught up with them and ran them both through. The bandit leader got to his feet. "I'll not go alone," he screamed, bolting towards the elf with his knife in his hand. Realizing Lee was too far away to do anything, Gooey sprung to his feet, rushing headlong towards the bandit leader. Gooey tackled the bandit just before he was able to plunge the knife into the elf's chest and sent the two of them crashing to the ground. The bandit landed on top, pinning Gooey. The boy feared for his life as the bandit began to hack at him maniacally. He instinctively lifted his arms to defend himself and felt pain shoot through his body as the knife found flesh. He could see blood splatter as one final blow struck home deep in his chest. It was then Lee reached them, plunging the sword through the bandit leader's back. Lee ran to Gooey's side as the man gasped and fell to the ground. "Fool," he cursed as he tore open Gooey's shirt. Blood poured from the gaping wounds covering his arms and chest. "I told you to stay put." "I'm sorry, Lee," he said weakly. "I guess I'm not much of a hero." Lee smiled. "Nonsense. Your father would have been very proud of you." Lee tore Gooey's shirt into strips and pressed one of them into the wound in his chest. The rest he wrapped around the cuts on his arms. "I'll be right back. I have salve that will stop the bleeding." Lee dashed off, leaving Gooey lying on the ground, wondering if this was the end. He turned his head and noticed the elf woman, still bound, staring at him. "Don't worry, miss," said Gooey. "I'll have Lee untie you when he gets back." The elf woman gave no reaction. Gooey had never seen an elf before, and he had heard very little about them. She looked almost human. She was thin, though clearly not frail, and her skin was dark bronze. Her long auburn hair fell loosely about her shoulders, and despite the bruises on her face, Gooey could tell that she was quite beautiful. He guessed she was about as tall as most human women. In fact, her narrow, piercing eyes and her distinctly elfish ears were the only features that suggested she was anything else. It was only a few minutes before Lee returned and began tending Gooey's wounds. "Stop," said Gooey. "Untie her." Lee shook his head, but he could see that Gooey was determined. "Very well," he sighed, and walked over to the elf woman and cut her bonds. She got up and stared at Lee for a moment. Lee tensed, ready to draw his weapon. She backed away slowly until she reached the edge of the bandit camp, then turned and ran into the woods. "You're welcome," Lee called after her sarcastically. There we go.
Very good. Very good, Brian. And I like to. I know that your son was a big part of this book, and you have been saying that your son was responsible for actually conceiving the idea for the Godling Chronicles. And I'd like to ask Jonathan, what gave you the idea for the Godling Chronicles?
Sure.
What gave you the idea for the Chronicles?
Huh? Hello.
Hello. Jonathan, what gave you the idea to help your dad with the book?
I was born, and I had a we got a new movie, Percy Jackson Lightning Thief, and I started watching it, and at the end I came up with this story, and I told my dad and my mom and dad the story, and my dad liked it so much he wanted to make a book out of it.
Cool. And did you have anything to do with Gooey? I mean, did your dad kind of work that character around you, do you think?
Wait, what?
Was Gooey you? Do you think Gooey was made for you? Do you think you were Gooey?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
That was my question. You stole my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's
go ahead,
okay.
Robin. You must have another one, Robin. Go right ahead.
No, my other question is how many when you were reading the story that your father wrote based on your concept, how many times did you have to go in and make corrections and tell him that he had it all wrong and that it needs to be this way? Like, in other words, how much did you take over?
None. Really? Yeah,
none.
You're all right.
Oh. I thought maybe you would step in there and say, no, Dad, sorry. I think this guy should act this way, or this guy should act or look this way, and she should look a certain way. I thought maybe, you know, you made corrections to his whole idea, the way he wrote it out.
No, he got it right on the bat.
Wow, that's cool.
That's right.
So you gave him a good description then.
Uh-huh.
Very good.
Jonathan, he's not threatening you in any way by what you're saying, is he?
Wait, sorry.
Like, he's not going to punish you for saying that you disagreed with him, is he? All right. Hey, Brian, you there?
Yes. Oh, my dad? Oh.
Yep.
Hello.
Okay, Brian. Yeah, very, very interesting kid there you got, and it's very,
you know,
good that we're
such
going to.
Inspiration to me. You know, he even came out with something. He always was coming up with these new things. When he was like 3 years old, this is a true story, we had this red kind of glass mosaic-looking vase on the dining room table.
Mm-hmm.
And at 3 years old, came up with this story about a man and a king fighting on top of a volcano. He got that from just looking at this vase.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and without him, you know, honestly, the stuff I usually write is really dark, you know, and what he's really done for me is lighten it up to where...
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, and make it, and turn, you know, dark sort of cerebral type things into more of a fun story that, frankly, is a lot more fun to write.
Yes.
You know, and it's always interesting with children, you know, their perceptions, when they see things differently than we do as adults, and I don't know when that point comes, but somewhere along the line, it's almost like we lose a little bit of that innocent, just the creativity, the things that, you know, when you think back, even playing with your Tonka trucks, and I mean
yeah.
For me,
yeah,
I played with Barbie,
especially when they were
you
made
know
of
how
metal,
you would
they last forever.
Oh yeah, you. They're plastic now, if you remember, you know, you would create these whole storylines in your mind as you were playing, and I mean, you know, literally, you could entertain yourself for hours on end. You know,
I still
do that,
Robert.
Oh, I mean, kids
well,
just amazing.
He can certainly entertain himself. That is no doubt about it. What I think happens, though, Robin, is as we get older, I think we trade off that raw creativity for depth. You know what I mean? For intricacies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's harder to reach it, but once we've reached it, we have the depth when we get older to, you know, make it a fuller story.
Yeah. Well, and plus, even those who are not writers, I mean, I know we're always told that how, you know, it's drilled into us. We have to live in reality, that's fantasy, that's kid stuff, and, you know, and it's time to grow up. And it's a
Absolutely.
Shame because children really tap into that whole fantasy. I mean, I even remember my little sister, she used to make for her house, her dolls, she used to stand books straight up, and then she would make like furniture out of books and then take a washcloth and that would be the blanket and for the bed. And I mean, she would, you know, incorporate other objects to make little dishes and things, and kids just, they visualize things in a different way than the way we process it.
Well, what you're,
you know, we could look at a bottle cap.
It reminds me of a psychological study I heard one time about how do you get an elephant into, how does an elephant get into a refrigerator? And adults would sit there and just try to over intellectualize it until, you know, they just, you know, trying to think of how you do this. Do you cut him up? Do you do what? Do you got to kill him first? You know, all this kind of stuff. And kids simply said, you open the door and let him in.
Yeah, I know.
They could imagine the elephant walking into the refrigerator.
It's just as simple as that.
Kind of the magical mind of a child that is able to conceive of these things that us adults haven't really thought about, and we're too kind of stuck.
We're
in
hung up on
page.
The suspension of disbelief. That's what it is.
Exactly.
You know, in a lot of ways.
I think it's really important for kids when they're young, for instance, when they're picking up a comic book, to continue reading comic books into their teen years. A lot of times, adults frown upon that.
That my son reads on 2 grade levels higher than he is in, and I attribute that, believe it or not, to Japanese anime. Japanese anime, the stuff in Japanese, not the translated, the stuff with the subtitles. He enjoys it, and the way he got to be such a good reader was that he had to read the subtitles in order to follow the story.
That makes a lot of sense.
There's no way to pause this if it's on, you know, I mean, I guess there is, but, you know, when you're a kid, you're not thinking pause it. You're trying to read fast enough to follow the story. And I think it was in Sweden or Norway or somewhere like that, they actually did a study about that, and they found the kids that watch foreign anime with subtitles read better than kids who
did.
It's more visual, I think, and the visuality of it helps them to continue with their reading. I think once you get into an adult age, you're more prone to kind of delve into the actual writing of it instead of looking. You don't need pictures anymore. Of course, I need pictures all the time. But Brian, the elf woman, Kaylee, as you well know, is a very intriguing character to me, and her interactions with the humans, and of course, Gooey, is filled with very interesting and stimulating conflict. Can you tell us more about how you developed her and how you apply conflict in your story?
Well, with Kalia, I wanted to have a strong woman with, I don't like writing weak characters if it's not necessary, because everybody has weaknesses and strengths. With Kalia, and especially with her, I tried to write her strong, but she's young. You got to understand, even though she's over 100 years old, by elf standards, she's an adolescent. So I tried to give her a sense of strength, but also with that kind of untempered, untempered rage and anger.
Yeah,
but
the angst.
And the angst and the defiance of youth. Sort of like a perfect combination for somebody like Gooey, who is basically finding out that he's not at what he thought he was, and as you find out in the story with the way the elves feel about the gods, almost like a perfect match. You know, I mean, for her defiance, for her angst, for her anger, who else would she fall in love with?
And I also, in line with that, with the elf line there, I've also find it interesting that in your book, the elves struggling but learning to get along with one another after 500 years, the humans and the elves, that is. And is there a message that we as a society can take from their story? And is that what you intended when you wrote it?
Well, you know, it's pretty much a classic struggle between two different types of two different peoples, whether it's in modern times we have, you know, between religions, races, and things like that. It's a pretty typical story. With the elves especially, I didn't want to make them very Tolkien-like and very hippie-like. I wanted to make them an actual people with actual problems, with, you know, with social problems, with divisions, and like any people really would be. You know, I mean, they're not some ethereal, emotionless, almost godlike themselves. I didn't want to make them that way. And if right. that's the case, if I do that, then they are very different from humans. There is going to be strife.
And but they're still in their own way. They're still the same as us.
They're
even
though
they're not human, but I'm saying that they have the same struggles and the same issues that a human
that
would
any
have.
Society does. Yeah, exactly. That
yeah.
any society has. And as you find out during the story about the Great War, you have two sides, the way two different people view this. And what mm-hmm. happened to cause a division in the, between the elves mm-hmm. and what caused civil strife within their own race. Now, then, of course, then there's what actually happened. You know, what's the old saying? There's, you know, three sides to every story.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want it like that. I didn't want to make them this unreal type people, which I see too often in fantasy when people include elves into the story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you possibly give us a glimpse into book two?
Oh, absolutely. Now, as you know, it leaves off with a cliffhanger. I'm not going to tell what happens in the end. I let the reader know exactly how that's resolved in the prologue. Book two is primarily about Guli's realization and Lee's realization, though he's a little bit more hesitant, that they either need to bring the elves in on the sides of the humans or at least get them to stay out of it. Now, he finds a way to do this. Now, this is where you start to realize that many elves still hate the gods and still hate humans, because in book one you see a lot of the ones that are coming the other way. So in book two, I show a lot of the real divisions and hatred that a large part of elf society has for the humans. And also delve into Lee's relationship with his family, not just his mother. And pretty much that's what the title of the book is, Of Gods and Elves. So
okay.
I'm about three quarters of the way finished.
Oh, okay. I was just going to ask you when it's due out.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be out probably, as it stands now, in the fall.
Okay.
That's what we're shooting for, assuming editing goes as planned.
Very good.
Yeah, that's the thing, is once you get it before the editors, then it's it's a whole nother story.
Oh, man, I love them, though.
You think
they
it's done,
me,
and then all of a sudden,
like I can
bam.
Hide.
Like, hello,
make me sound like I know what I'm doing
here.
Oh my goodness. Now, I couldn't live without the copy editors and the I tell you what though, I found with writing a full length novel that just as important as the editors are proofreaders.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't care who you are, get as many proofreaders as you can talk into proofreading. The
yeah.
most detailed people you know, if you know mathematicians or music teachers or whoever you might know, you know, get them to proofread for you even after editing, because the best editor in the world is going to miss stuff.
Yeah. And one thing that I know from a personal standpoint is when you go through your second, third, fourth, and fifth draft yourself before you even pass it on to your proofreaders, it's like you're looking at the same thing over and over and over again, and it's so easy to overlook mistakes because you're not reading it from an objective viewpoint. So
well,
you know what you... basically, right. You know what you're... what you meant your character to say, and then somebody else reads it, and then they come back with, well, what were they trying to say there? So then, you know, it is good to have proofreaders because they help you find all the little plot holes and maybe, you know, tie up any loose strings that you forgot to go back. And, you know, and that way you by the time you're ready to turn it into the actual editors, you are turning in as clean a manuscript as you can possibly get it to. And it just makes things so much easier.
I usually only get to about a third draft. I can only do about three drafts before I just don't want to deal with it anymore.
I didn't want to deal with it after I wrote it on my first draft. I was like, okay, it's ready to go. And then people were reading it and they were like, oh, it's a great story, but
sort of take it for a while, you know? Because I get sort of so close to the story, I can't think objectively anymore.
That's what happens.
So I turn it over to proofreaders and editors and whoever, or even just get it line edited, if not copy edited, and just do that. And that way I'm at least separated for the story for at least a few weeks. So when I go back to it, it's fresh again.
Yeah, that's what I do. That's exactly what I do. And that's when I find my mistakes anyway, because I just wrote the greatest, that was the greatest line ever. And then a month later, I go back and read it and I say, oh, what in the world? What did I just write there? What is this?
What were you thinking? This is utter garbage.
I really suffer
from, you know, that whole, you know, the self-esteem issues that I think a lot of writers, most writers, you kind of have that self-doubt that you're never going to be good enough. And it's like you got to compete against everybody else. And I drive myself crazy trying to re-edit and re-edit and re-edit. And I've been told by four different writers, walk away. Girl, walk away and just leave it alone because you're going to end up editing it into nothing. There'll be nothing
left.
You're
going to take all the flavor out of it. You want to leave your style in there as well. You know, I mean, every writer has his own style of writing, the way they word things, what they say, and the way their descriptives are. I mean, myself, I tend to not be overly descriptive, but that's intentional. One of the things that I've always, like J.R. Tolkien's one of my favorite writers, right?
Yeah.
I'm not in any way comparing myself to him.
Right. No, I understand.
But he, I would have to have an ego the size of New York. He, as much as I love him, his writing is wonderful, but even I get sort of feeling belabored by the description and just find myself skipping over things to get to what's going on.
Yeah, you're bogged down.
Story.
It's overdone.
And so what I try to do and what makes it actually easier as far as, if I see a building, I give a rough description of what the building looks like. And if it needs more detail, I'll let somebody who's read it say, hey, you need a little bit more detail in there.
Otherwise, you can also
overdo the detail too. There was something I read not too long ago about the writers when they were explaining how to write, but they would get into the description of a fly when that wasn't part of the story, and it would go on and on and on about this fly and the shape of its wings and how it flapped its wings and where it was on the table. But it pulled the reader away from what the storyline was. So there's a little bit of work you have to do with when you're writing a story, not to get too involved in detail. I like detail, but you can overdo it.
I agree with that because I like to write. My preference is post-apocalyptic fiction and primarily in zombies, and so of course. I would say the mass majority of writers within that subgenre are men, and a lot of times they are either current or ex-military or gun nuts, and they get so bogged down into the details about guns and what type of the caliber of the bullets. And I mean, I couldn't do it because I'm not a gun person. So, but as a reader, that really starts to get to me when there's so much attention paid on that aspect of the story instead of just, you
know.
What's
going on? See, I'm trying to make
yeah,
my,
what's going on? Just say what's going on. He pulled out a gun, he shot the zombie, and the blood spurted out at the back of the brain, you know, the skull or whatever. And that's it. I really don't care what gun he used, what the caliber was, and how fast it flew, and, you know, all these the technicalities.
I agree totally. You know, I still want to be more character-driven. You know, I mean, and if you haven't noticed by the way I've developed the characters in the Goblin Chronicles, I give a lot of attention to detail up to who they are. What is their personality like? Why should I care about them? How do they interact with the other characters? Because, you know, I mean, to me that's what makes it interesting, you know. The people in it, you know, I mean, especially with sci-fi fantasy, you see a lot of writers will get too bogged down also into the fantastical end of it and forget to develop the characters and to make them believable and to make them lovable or hate or you know, or despicable or whatever they need to make them.
Yeah, because
and,
what would you care if they end up dying later on if you haven't related in some way on, you know, on some level to that character?
Exactly, and you know, that's what I, you know, and even as a reader, I enjoy stories that tell you more about who this person is, and, you know, if they have a quirk, what, you know, I mean, you don't tell them right away why they, you know, scratch the back of their head all the time, but, you know, you notice that, then later on, you give a little bit more information, like with Lee. I, you know, left a goodly portion of his life out of there because I pick up on it later on. And the same with Gooey. You know, I mean, there's so much more to know. I tell you, there's so much more to know.
Getting with the character, Brian, I was very, very, I fall in line with your, and I would agree wholeheartedly with what you talked about as far as developing your characters. I think it's very good when you do that rather than just put a character out there and have all the details come to them. You're kind of developing the story from within the character out instead of the other way around. And when you're developing a character, does the character tend to control you or do you control the character more in your story?
Well, it starts out me controlling the character because I got to put the personality kind of into play. And then once I have that established well enough, then it sort of takes on more of a life of its own, you know, like Maybelle. I couldn't exactly have Maybelle dancing around like a giddy little girl. She's an old lady. You know, so she's got to do what she would do. She's got to react the way I have portrayed her. So I can't really, I mean, I guess I could just, but it wouldn't ring true. You know, so I got, once they're established, I sort of got to let them do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. And do they
usually... that falls in line with the whole showing and not telling.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
You know, if you have a young kid...
You're revealing their characters through their actions and the way they interact with each other within the story, as opposed to
what they're afraid of,
cheating.
What their strengths are, but more importantly, what their weaknesses are. What are their quirks?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, anybody can make a hero that can kill 100, you know, I guess, then zombies. I mean, but
story,
you can make a strong hero, but to make a character that has flaws, that has quirks, that has faults, as well
that
as
you can relate to
things as a person that you can relate to. Now, I mean, the ultimate hero is not very interesting. You know, even Superman later on, they gave him, even Superman has kryptonite, you know, I mean, every hero has his weaknesses and flaws and, you know, things that, you know, that make them more believable.
Well, I think it's really great that your son came up with this whole concept just by, you know, watching fantasy movies and kind of indulging in his own little fantasy world while he's, you know, as he's been growing up and playing in different books that he's read and all of those things influenced him and helped to inspire this story. I'm really proud. How old is he?
He will be 9 in March.
See, now that that's amazing. That's amazing.
Kind of keeps the kid in you, right, Brian? It keeps you kind of in line with your imagination. Because if you didn't have Jonathan,
he really puts me in touch with that part of me
right.
that enjoyed reading fantasy as a young man, and as a kid. And he kind of reminds me of that because, like I said, the stuff I was writing at the time was very dark, you know. And I enjoy it. I thought, you know, I think it's good, but you know, this is so much more fun to write. I owe it all to my son's imagination. I mean, the prologue is almost action for action what he described to me. The main character and what he is was all him. Lee was all him.
Well,
wow.
Brian, we got about a little over 4 minutes here left, and I know you had a subject that you wanted to talk about and any other subject matters regarding your writing life or your book. Would you like to go ahead and expand on that subject that you were talking about in Facebook a little while ago?
Sure. First, I'd like to say thank you to all the people who have been supportive of me here in New York. All over the world, I've been getting great support in countries like India, Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines. Also, my hometown of Spanish Fort and Baldwin County, and here, like I said, here in New York. And to any writers that may be listening to this program and that who sit there and stare and stare and stare at the Amazon ratings, you need to stop doing that. Get out there with your book, sell it one-on-one. You're going to, number one, unless it's purely just on Kindle, I understand, then you got to do what you got to do. But there's so many other markets out there, so many other creative ways to sell a book, especially if you're an independent writer. Your options are wide open.
Absolutely.
Yes. Brian, where can we find you on the web?
Well, right now I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/thegodlingchronicles. And I haven't set up my website as of yet.
Well, come and talk to me about that, my friend. Come and talk to me about that, my friend, and we'll work something out, and we will be announcing something. I don't have time right now to announce it, but on the next show. And if you want to hook up with me, Brian, I'll work with you on that website.
Absolutely. I'd love to, Tom.
Okay. Well, we thank you very much for being on, and Jonathan and Brian, you've been great guests today on the Writer's Lounge. And once again, everybody get out there and go to your local bookstore online and buy a copy of The Godling Chronicles. You can find it, I believe, in hardcover out there and also in e-format. So, Brian, thank you for being on, and we'll have you on again. In fact, I want to hook up with you and see if you might want to be an administrator on the Writer's Lounge page, since you spent an awful lot of time there and have promoted the show so much over the years. I really do appreciate all that you're doing for us, and thank you for being a friend to me in the last several months.
So, I appreciate it, too.
Yes.
Y'all
okay,
been great,
Brian.
And I've had so much fun. Thanks, Robin. Thank you, Tom.
Oh, you're welcome.
See you later, Jonathan.
Say bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Little cutie patootie.
He sure was. I think it's great that we've got kids involved in writing. And once again, we can start with this Writer's Corner, Robin, and get that started. And maybe on the next show, I can come up more of a format to get that segment started on the show. So I think that's
I think it's an excellent idea.
Yeah, I think it's great. So that's pretty much it. We got seconds left, and we'll see you next week. We'll be interviewing Brett Williams, And I believe, and I'm going to screw this up, The Brockton Inn is the name of the book, and he'll be there with us next week on the Writer's Lounge. And until then, good reading and good writing. And good
night. You know, you got me all excited. I thought you were going to say Brett Michaels. And I just, from Poison.
Yeah.
the rock star. Yeah. I was like, Brett Michaels, really?
Say good night, Robin.
Good night.
Good night. See you later. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
In the middle of the day, your faith and your fences have been blown away. You're down in the cellar and you've locked yourself in. Ah, but it looks like it's rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. Morn. He said, Noah, get ready, for the sky will be torn. Build as I tell you, save what you can. Then wait while the rainbow weather begins. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. Storm clouds apart and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out on a westerly wind. And it looks like it's rainbow weather again. Trouble will come, but trouble will go. You're living in fear, but what do you know? You know that the sun's always coming then. You know there'll be rainbow weather again. It looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds will part and the sun will peek in. The rain will roll out. Like it's rainbow weather. Yeah, it looks like it's rainbow weather again. The storm clouds.